Today we start something new with somebody who's been around for quite a few years on our show. Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of the radio and online program Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Today he joins us to start a new series of chats that occur every month here on Main Street. We're calling them Philosophical Currents. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
I'm super happy to be here, and I'm really excited about this project. I always have so much to say, and, you know, I want people to listen to me. But also, you're such a great interlocutor. I love getting the chance to talk to you and the chance to address the state, so I couldn't be happier.
Well, we were struggling with what should be our first topic, and then, of course, we ripped it right from the headlines because it's there. The March 23rd issue of The Atlantic says, quote, "While reports of hate crimes declined last year in 16 of America's largest cities, reports of those against Asian Americans surged nearly 150%. A Pew Research survey conducted in June, just a few months into the pandemic, found that an astonishing 31% of Asian Americans said they had experienced some form of discrimination since the pandemic began." Jack, hate crimes against Asian Americans have been in the headlines. How does a philosopher approach this kind of problem?
Well, the first thing is, I think, like you, I didn't know what to start with because I kind of wanted to talk about something happy, right? There's so much awfulness in the news. There's so much just darkness. But this is an urgent topic. And one of the best ways to talk about an urgent topic is to diffuse the situation, is to sort of walk away from the anger and the hostility. And philosophy does that really well, right? Philosophy can engage abstractly and try to bring the conversation out to its best, most general, most, you know, critical thinky kind of stuff. And I also was concerned because, of course, you and I, as far as I know about you, are not of Asian descent.
Correct.
And in our culture, when we want someone to advocate for a group, we almost always want to center someone who's a member of that group. And so there's already a philosophical difficulty, which is how much can a member of one subgroup understand or speak about or even speak for, advocate for a member of another group? And that's a huge issue. That's the issue of the time. And, you know, I have a 15-year-old daughter, and her generation is awash in the idea that representation is the single most important issue. And so there is something a little awkward about you and I having this conversation alone. On the other hand, that's the burden of being Prairie Public's resident philosopher.
Well, what does connecting a deadly pandemic to an American minority group say about education and critical thinking abilities among the general population?
Well, so one of the problems with hate crimes in general is that it engages a fallacy, and the fallacy is called generalizing from the particular, right? It's you see a black cat once and you have bad luck, so you think that every time you're going to see a black cat, you're going to have bad luck. You know, spit on your baseball glove in order to win the World Series, and then you want to do that every single time. So bigotry is in the same category of superstition. You think this one thing about this one Asian person, or you have this one experience with this black person, or what have you, and then you think it's true of everybody. And so there's just something fundamentally logically flawed about bigotry and discrimination, and hate crimes are examples of that. And I also want to say the phrase hate crime can be a little misleading. Because I think a lot of our listeners are going to say, you know, I don't hate Asians. I don't hate African Americans. I don't hate anybody. I love everybody. And so I'll actually tell you a little story. It was quite a few years ago. In Grand Forks, there was a Mongolian barbecue. It's a different one that is here now. It's family owned, very small. And then it closed all of a sudden. And I was taking a walk with a friend of mine who was my age and who was born and raised in central North Dakota. And I mentioned how sad it was that I liked the restaurant. And she said, "I heard they were serving dog." And I said, "They weren't serving dog." And she said, well, why would people say that then? I said, because they're racist, right? And then we sort of talked about that, and I sort of laughed about the comment. But this idea that gets associated with Asian people, that they serve dog because in some cultures, in some Asian cultures, dog was a reasonably common food, particularly for the poor folks. They assume that all meat, or they talk about it as if all meat is that. And that permeates a community, right? But this is where the logic fails, because this was a restaurant that was, you know, in addition to wanting to earn money, they also have to get meat from local suppliers, and they have to be inspected, and people are going to know the taste of things. And so all evidence suggests that they weren't serving dog, but people are inclined to believe it because they have these illogical associations with Asians. And so the word hate in hate crime, I think, doesn't do justice to the breadth of experience that we have to engage in when we talk about bigotry, discrimination, stereotyping, and hate crimes in general.
So is there any logic behind this? It seems like you're hinting at there might be, but is this a nature or nurture reaction? What's sort of the root that makes us look at some people differently?
I think if anything is innate about this, it's the us versus them instinct, right? Human beings are tribal creatures. We evolved to be tribal. And almost all of our political fissures and almost all of our suspicions revolve around an us-them axis, right? And so we're good, they're bad. We're trustworthy, they're not. And the nurture aspect, the cultural aspect, is what us and them, how that's defined, right? Different cultures are going to define us in different ways and them in different ways. And not just because different cultures are different ethnicities or different skin tones or different religions, but also because different cultures prioritize different things, right? Us may be, a Minnesota Wild fan, right? Us may be a redhead. Us may be a UND student, right? Us can be anything. And so depending on the history of your region, depending on the history of your family, depending on the history of your culture, the us and them gets defined differently. And Asians have always been a them in American culture. Asians have always been an other, as the term has been used. And we like to think that we're past that. We like to think that we're above that, but clearly we're not. And so at times of insecurity, that us-them thing kicks in to a higher degree because people are trying to protect themselves, and it gets aimed at this general population who were just as lovely and generous and kind and interesting and awful and suspicious and as any other group.
The Asian American community reminds us that the recent spike in reported hate crime incidents goes along with an extensive history of discrimination, going back to immigration quotas. We needed a railroad, but internment camps. We were fighting the Japanese, and oh, we've got these people who are somewhat Japanese in California. This is generations old. When does it become just stupid?
Well, it was always stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the worst and most dangerous terms is normal. And I don't mean that it's bad to have cultural norms and expectations, but we think things are logical or they make sense because they're familiar to us. And so this otherness of the Asian population just sort of makes sense to some people. They look at a group of people and they think they look differently than me. They have different food than me. They have a different language than me. So they're other. You know, the other complication with Asian statistics in particular is that Asian means a bunch of different things,
yeah,
right? There's East Asian, right? Japanese and Chinese and Koreans. There's South Asian, which are Indians and Pakistanis and Bangladeshis. There's Central Asian, which is folks from the Central Soviet Republic, and Mongolia. And so the very idea of associating all these people is about the continent and about the region, not about the people themselves. So, you know, this is one of the difficulties. One of the difficulties is if you call someone from India the same group or the same term that you call someone from Japan or Korea, there's something weird about that, and there's something artificial about that. And so it's some of it is just stupid, right? As you suggest in the beginning, some of it is habit and some of it is convenience, because we do often use these terms just because it's easier to say these terms and to describe people or groups in these terms. And so you have to always be aware that all of these ideas and all these concepts and all these terms are shortcuts for a much larger concept that needs to be unpacked.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which you hear on the Prairie Public Network once a month. We're inaugurating a new program element today we call Philosophical Currents. We'll take current events out of the headlines and talk about the sort of the philosophy behind the issue and maybe how we can move beyond it. Jack, your area of specialization is political philosophy. So let's talk about lip service, the politics of saying something that supposedly ameliorates, sounds good, but doesn't do anything, and dog whistles, which we've had plenty of in the last few years.
Because these ideas are, you know, instantiated in the language, because, as I was saying before, that the terminology is a shortcut, we often think that if we alter the language, it resolves the problem. We often think that if we only say the right thing, it changes the equation. And that can be true, and it often is not true. It's not true when someone is giving lip service and when someone is just saying something to avoid being attacked or to hide their true feelings. But it can be true, particularly when a marginalized group takes words that were slurs or weapons and reclaims them for their own use. So the word queer for a long time was a slur against homosexuals, and now the queer community very proudly calls themselves that, right? Many folks who listen are old enough to recognize that Black Americans for a while were called colored, and that was the acceptable term. And then they were called Negro, which was the acceptable term. And then they were called Afro-Americans and then Black and then African-Americans and now people of color, although that's a larger category. And so all of that is a way of the group saying, you keep pointing to us as if we're a bad thing, but we're actually a good thing, and we're proud of ourselves. We have pride, not in the sense that we're superior to anyone. That's the difference between, say, Asian pride and white pride or white supremacy, is that in white supremacy, people think that being white is better than other things. But for something like Asian pride, it's about saying, all my life, people have said what I am is negative, it's ugly, it's sexualized, it's all these other things. And none of that is true. I'm just proud of who I am, and I'm comfortable with who I am. And I want to assert that who I am is good, not bad. And so because some of this is a problem of language, the language either exacerbates the problem, can be used as a weapon, or can be a healing aspect and can take us to the next stage where we can really look at the conceptual ideas.
Well, you talked about language. I can think of a couple of phrases that have been grossly overworked in recent years: cancel culture and political correctness. Sometimes at odds with each other, but they're sort of a shorthand for what I feel and why I feel it.
So the problem with those terms is that while they have some real descriptive power of what's happening in the world, there is a certain kind of cancel culture right now that we can talk about. It's also used as a weapon. It's also used to delegitimize people who want a more diverse and just society. So let me just take a simple example. Lots of people know, and we were inundated with the idea that Dr. Seuss was being canceled, right? And, you know, how awful it is, and cancel culture and cancel culture and cancel culture. But Dr. Seuss wasn't canceled. What happened was the estate of Dr. Seuss, his descendants who own the rights to the book, it's their books, it's their property. There were a couple books, very unpopular books, as it turned out, very rarely read books, that depicted Asian Americans very negatively. They used stereotypical language and they used stereotypical images. And the estate said, hey, these are our books and they're old fashioned and they don't communicate the message that Dr. Seuss is supposed to communicate. So we are going to stop publishing this stuff that we own. Now, that's not cancel culture. That's rational, you know, thoughtful ways of thinking about the world. There are certainly words that I have used and certainly things that I have written at one time that I thought, you know what? Ooh, I don't want that out there. I've outgrown it and I just don't want it there anymore. And so when you look at what actually happened with Dr. Seuss, it was a minor thing with tremendous meaning. But what the opponents of, you know, very conservative and Fox News pundits tried to do was talk about that in terms of censorship and oppression and cancel culture. And so I'm always really careful about using those phrases because while they do have core meanings that are useful, more often than not, they're just weapons to delegitimize a whole spectrum of points of view.
Race, ethnicity, gender, religion, always we can define and conquer, I suppose, is one way to put it. But why do we do it? Why? What's the impulse to do that?
I actually want to sort of answer a sub-question that was implicit in that, because, of course, why we do it is out of habit. Why we do it is that us and them. Why we do it is because it's politically expedient. But I think the interesting question that comes from what you're asking is sort of the inverse, which is if we don't want to divide and conquer, if we don't want to be racist, then why have these group-focused ideas like hate crimes, right? Why do we consistently talk about, analyze, and punish crimes of certain races or certain ethnicities or religions more than others, right? And the answer is actually really interesting. After World War II, when the Nazis were being tried for their crimes, there was no category to describe what they had done, right? There was no category to describe the systematic attempt to destroy, using industry, an entire people. And so the international legal community invented two terms. The first was genocide. Genocide is a legal term, didn't exist before. And the second was crime against humanity. And the idea of a crime against humanity is that there's crimes that are so large and that are of a certain type that they're not just crimes against the individual victim. They're also crimes against the people who the individual victims have certain relationships to. In the case of crime against humanity, it's all people. When you commit genocide against an entire people, you're victimizing the entire human race. And so what happens with hate crimes is we want to say two things. We want to say there are individual victims who are the victims of slurs or abuse or violence or theft or other things. But we also want to say that these crimes are so big and of a certain type that run counter to the very core of our democracy, right? The core of our democracy is that we welcome difference of opinion, difference of experience, different race, different nations. We welcome difference. And when you commit a crime because of a person's background, when you commit a bias crime, which is the other term that it's called, or a hate crime, you're not just victimizing the individual, you're victimizing everyone who shares whatever characteristic the individual has that you're attacking. And so the idea of hate crimes and bias crimes is a direct consequence of the lessons we learned from World War II, which is there are some crimes that are larger than the individual victim, and they're larger than the named people. It's also the group. And sometimes that group is the whole human race, but sometimes that group is Asians or Sikhs or Jews or what have you.
And if we look at today's headlines, African Americans, the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer accused in the murder of George Floyd, which caused a worldwide eruption of reaction when it happened last May. Part of that would seem to be, if you look at a legislature, if you look at Congress, it does not reflect the greater society. It's mostly older white guys. And that gets to another political philosopher's question here. In a democratic society, how might a philosopher's approach ensure the rights of minority populations while respecting the authority of majority rule?
It's a really, really good and really tough question in some areas, right? What are the limits of free speech? That's a really rich question. What are the limits of gun rights? That's a really interesting question. The question of protecting individual minorities involves, and you'll recognize this phrase, not erasing the people we're talking about. So for example, and I'm not, you know, I don't want to think for a second that I'm criticizing you, but for example, we're talking about Asian hate crimes, and you logically bring up Black Lives Matter stuff and the things that happened in Minneapolis. And the proper response to that from a political point of view is that stuff is really important and we need to talk about that. But right now we're talking about Asians. And so what's happening in our culture at this very moment, for really ugly reasons, is we're talking about Asian victims and Asian hate crimes. Then we can talk about these other things. And if you can do that, if you can say, let's talk about this group, then we'll talk about this group, then we'll talk about this group, and we're not prioritizing one as more important than another, we are saying, right now, that's what's in the news. Right now, this is the most urgent question. Then we start to recognize the fact that what we call a minority is actually a majority.
We're all coalitions, ultimately.
That's not only absolutely right, I think that's a beautiful way of saying it. We're all coalitions.
Well, we run against the clock. Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, monthly on Prairie Public's radio network, and this new element for Main Street, Philosophical Currents. Jack, it's always a pleasure.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks, Doug.